Welcome to Reading and Drinking. My name is Jill Zamorski, and this is our final episode for season two of Reading and Drinking. On today's episode, I am going to be talking about a book entitled Terroir Footprints by Pedro Parra. There is a little bit of a subtitle here. It reads, A Fascinating Trip to the Great World of Terroir, Burgundy, Barolo, Sonoma, Montalcino, Itata, Gredos, Oregon, Sicily, .. This episode is sponsored by Eldon Selections, which is an online Burgundy-only wine retailer, and it's the largest of its kind in the United States. Eldon Selections specializes in small production hidden gem Burgundy wines, and they have a range from everyday Bourgogne to some of the most prestigious Grand Cru vineyards in Burgundy. Burgundy is such a special area. It is deceptively simple. They make red wines and white wines from Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, but it's also the most complicated and convoluted place on earth. And if it's an area that you want to explore, having an importer who is willing to help navigate and guide and bring you the best of all the different styles of wine is an invaluable resource. Go to burgundywine.com/somme to browse five different specialty cases that have been created exclusively for Somme TV. You can also use the promo code SOMM, S-O-M-M, to save 15% on your first purchase of $300 or more. This is a brand new book. It came out in 2020, and it's written by a man named Pedro Parra. He's from Chile, and he's about 50 years old, and he is widely regarded and highly esteemed as a terroir consultant. His story is a really interesting one, and to my knowledge, this is the first book that he's ever written, and it's an autobiography. It starts in the beginning, in his childhood in Chile, and sort of how he got into, well, studying terroir, and it's taken him all over the world. Full disclosure, this book is a translation. He's from Chile. He speaks Spanish. He does also speak several other languages, having received two different graduate degrees in France, but it is a translation. So every now and then you might just come across the way it reads is a little bit maybe unusual, but it's a beautiful book. It's a big book. It is 437 pages, and it is divided essentially into 17 chapters, bookended by an intro and then acknowledgments at the end. And one thing that the author makes clear throughout the entire book is aspects of his personality that have nothing to do with soil and terroir. He's really into film and music, and he got into it through his grandparents when he was a child. But as he's traveled all over the world, he often kind of punctuates stories about, you know, his work with mentioning a favorite restaurant to eat and drink or a favorite secondhand record shop where he would pick up some vinyl. And each of the 17 chapters tackles, you know, a different point in his life or a different place where he's worked. But for each of them, they begin with an illustration and like a one-page description of a famous jazz musician, specifically referencing an album or a song that was particularly impactful to the author. Full disclosure, I am widely regarded in my friend circle as having terrible taste in music. Can't change it. It is what it is. I appreciate lots of music, but I'm not very knowledgeable about plenty of it. And I am incredibly ignorant about jazz. And so this was something that like, it didn't really resonate with me. And if you are a music lover and a jazz aficionado, then you might love it. But I just sort of flip past that page. It is what it is. So this idea of being a terroir consultant, it's kind of a new field. And that's also something that Pedro Parra mentions throughout this entire book, is that he's kind of going into uncharted territory. He, as I mentioned, has two graduate degrees from different schools in France. Basically, for his master's degree, he studied kind of everything, soil and geology and agronomy. And he really got into making maps. He did a master's degree in territorial studies and landscape organization. And he used satellite images and GIS and some pretty technical stuff. And this ties into an actual style of viticulture that is employed all over the world today, which is called precision viticulture. And so we talk about, you know, organic farming and biodynamic farming, or, you know, lutte raisonnée, which is the raisin struggle that a lot of producers, like in Champagne, for example, where they do the minimum sort of human input and let the vines struggle on their own. Precision viticulture refers to using things like drones and electromagnetic charge pulses in the ground and aggregating all of this data to get more information. And there's huge pros and cons. Big pros because it's allowed Pedro Parra to, well, to be so successful as a terroir consultant, but it requires a fairly significant investment in, well, in equipment and someone who has the skills to interpret the data. So it's not for everybody. And then he did go back to France a few years after getting his master's degree to get a PhD in terroir at the Institut National Agronomique in Paris, Grignon. So he's spent a lot of time in France and he has traveled all over the world. He's not a geologist, though he certainly has taken lots of geology classes, but he reinforces that point throughout. But one of the things that he really focuses on is understanding the micro terroir of a particular growing area. So what does that mean? It's actually kind of interesting. And he explains, and I will say this, studying soil and rocks and geology and, you know, just terroir, it's interesting, but sometimes it's also a little bit boring. And I will say this, he does a really good job. His like analogies and his metaphors are really helpful. And oftentimes he talks about like food, about like soil fertility. And it would be like a vine that had the opportunity to have like gas station chocolate bar versus like the very best high quality Swiss chocolate. And like the effect that that would have on your body if you ate all of one and none of the other, or vice versa. And I found that tremendously helpful. It happens throughout the entire book. But he has this sort of approach that it ties in a lot with a previous book I reviewed this season called Vineyard Geology. And that book dealt specifically, I mean, it was mind-blowing if you listen to that review, and it dealt specifically with rocks, with the bedrock and then rock as it gets weathered and becomes to soil and how that relates to ultimately the taste in wine and questions whether it does actually have a relationship to the taste in wine. And I was very curious to see how this book and this author would tackle a very similar subject. And it does and it doesn't. So to this idea of understanding micro terroir, I kind of want to explain what it is he does. So one of the things that is talked about throughout this entire book is this quest of Pedro Parra's to catalog and describe micro terroir as opposed to macro terroir. So let's back up and talk about, first of all, what this concept of terroir is. It's a French concept. It technically does not have a direct translation, but what it really refers to is all of the elements about a particular place that can create a certain style of wine or typicity in whatever product is being produced. So it's the soil, it's the climate, it's the amount of precipitation, it's the degree of the slope and the aspect. It's also grape variety and rootstock and human intervention. It's all of these things. And it's important to know that the human element is part of terroir. And he mentions a couple times, he makes some really great points, that the concept of understanding terroir as it relates to viticulture, one of the problems is scale. And so he, again, with a really great analogy, describes it as, his example is, imagine there's somebody wearing a plaid shirt, and we're trying to observe this person who's wearing a plaid shirt from a distance and determine the color of their shirt. And the first step, imagine this person, it's a fictitious name, he's called Mr. Perez. In the first step of observing the color of the shirt, he would be 100 meters away from you. And so from 100 meters away, what we would see is something whitish, you know, a whitish color. So we would think that Mr. Perez is wearing a white shirt. But if we stand 25 meters away, we would see that the white of his shirt is not entirely white, that there's another color associated. It seems to be blue. And so it's not quite clear. We think that maybe he's wearing a bluish shirt or a blue and white shirt. Step three, we are 15 meters away from Mr. Perez. And now we realize, in fact, that the shirt he's wearing is checkered. It's plaid. And it clearly shows two colors, both blue and white. And then the fourth step is that Mr. Perez actually reaches out and greets us and shakes our hands or bumps elbows. And at that moment, we realize there's even more information and more colors than what we saw before. The shirt has a white background, but it has blue, light blue, and purple checks. And so that might seem like a long explanation for the difference between macro terroir and micro terroir, but the idea is, and he says this, is that oftentimes a vine growing area or vineyard is kind of overgeneralized in terms of the type of, you know, parent rock, bedrock, or soil type. But upon closer examination, there's actually a lot more variability and a lot more detail. One of the ways he actually goes about searching for this micro terroir and cataloging it is digging soil pits. And what a soil pit is, well, it's just that. It's a pit that you dig in between two rows of vines or in between vines in a vineyard. And it just goes straight down. I've been in a couple of them before, and typically it's like 2 or 3 feet wide, like the width of whatever backhoe bucket might be. And then it's, I don't know, 6 feet deep. I mean, it's not like you're getting buried or anything like that, but it allows you to see like the soil strata and the infiltration of roots through the soil. And it gives you lots of information. Everything from what the makeup of the soil is, the relative humidity of the soil, any sort of other composite matter, pebbles or gravels or things like that. And it can also tell you where the soil ends and the parent rock or the bedrock begins. And that's one thing that we definitely learned about, or I definitely learned about when I was reading vineyard geology, is that most of the minerals that make up bedrock are not bioavailable for uptake for vines. But you can see in a pit or in any other sort of way in a vineyard, you can see the infiltration of roots through the soil. And what they're searching for, at least according to the author of the Vineyard Geology book, is they're searching for water and then de facto by nutrients. And they absorb that water and the nutrients when they kind of make their way through the soil and the water that's trapped in between the grains of the soil, which certainly can include weathered and degraded rocks. And if there are fissures or fractures in the rock, then certainly root hairs can like infiltrate those rocks. The tricky part is, this is why reading is so important. This is why we're always perpetual students, is I almost feel a little bit more confused having read all of the books I read this season, because there is some conflicting and contrasting information. And so it just makes me want to like search more out for myself, because there isn't an answer. And look, Pedro Parra, he admits it, that there's not always an answer. And in fact, a large, if not the majority of his observations about cause and effect of different soil type or rock type and characteristic in wine, he straight up says it, that he doesn't, well, let me read to you what he says. He says, this is towards the end of the book, he says, for nearly 300 pages now, I've been gradually providing concepts and ideas and experiences, often hard to assimilate for a technically unskilled person. I'm just going to assume that that means me. And he's been talking about soils and rocks and minerality and typicity of wines in different places. He uses a soil scanner, and he does this over and over again. Sometimes, I'm not going to lie, it's a little bit boring. But he does it repeatedly to familiarize the reader with all of these concepts. Towards the end of the book, he has specific chapters where he is working with famous producers in Burgundy, in Meursault, and in Vosne Romanée. And he says he's doing his best to transmit his experience and vision from these zones to the reader. And he says, I'm well aware that whatever I write can be used against me. But the fact is, nobody else has written about this topic, the relation of soil, rock, wine, minerality, and typicity, all of those things together. He says it's difficult, and maybe that's why no one else has done it. And it's difficult for a few reasons, and this is key. First, and this is me quoting, because I have no evidence of it, except for my palate, and I may even never be able to prove it, making it even more fascinating for me. Some people need numbers to prove things, not me. Secondly, because it requires a lot of imagination and to have an open mind when trying to understand it, people with more structured mindsets will find this difficult. And third, because all of these above things are not easy to understand for those who've never visited or seen a terroir in Burgundy, and he assumes that many of the people who read this book have not been there yet. I have been to Burgundy, not nearly as much as Pedro Parra, and I don't have nearly his level of education. But that little bit right there, it really resonated with me, because I think of myself as a perpetual student. I'm always looking to understand the why. And I feel like if I ever had the opportunity to meet him, I would drive him crazy with my questions, because I do want to know the cause and effect. I do want to know the why. And he actually sets up this idea very early in the book, like within the first 10 pages. We're just becoming introduced to Pedro Parra. It's before he even gives us his biography and talks about his childhood. But he was in Paris for work, and he was invited to attend a tasting with some local sommeliers at a restaurant before the restaurant was open. And it was a blind wine tasting. So the wines were being poured, but nobody had any idea what their identity was. He describes it, and he's like running late. He's got to get to the airport. He's got a flight to catch. You know, he's a busy guy. He's like always jet lagged and spending a lot of time in airports. But he describes this tasting with this group of sommeliers, and there's jazz music playing in the background. Of course there is. So he's in a very, very happy place, but he's observing the sommeliers taste the wine and try to identify what it is. You know, that's what blind tasting is. Not that you can't see the wine, just you don't know, you don't see the bottle. You don't know what the wine is. And so you can tell if it's red or it's white. But the way he tastes, I don't know that I've ever tasted this way before. And this is why I think this man is genius. I just don't quite understand his genius. Because when he tastes the wines, he straight up talks about texture and direction, and he makes a connection with the soil type. It's an interesting way of tasting wine. I'll just kind of paraphrase. Wine number two out of these six wines. It's white wine. It's somewhat older, a little bit of a lighter pale color. His palate's awake when he tastes it, and so he feels it in his mouth. The chalk that comes from calcareous soils. The wine is electric and sharp like a sharp knife. Acid, very acid. It's fantastic for its purity and minerality, and people are confused. So am I. There's consensus that it's from the old world and from France, but everyone has their own theory. Some people think it's from the Jura. Some people think it's Burgundy. And his instinct tells him that it's Chenin Blanc from Saumur in the Loire Valley. He's only visited the Loire Valley once, mind you. And so he feels insecure. So he says that he stays silent and he doesn't say a word. The wine gets uncovered and it is revealed that it's a Guiberteau Brezé 2010 from Saumur Chopiny. So that's Chenin Blanc. That's a white wine from a great producer in the Loire Valley. So this is the part where I think to myself, like, oh my God, this like flies in the face of everything I know, because all of the blind tasting that I've learned how to do, we analyze the wine on so many different planes. We look at its color and that can tell you certainly like possible, you know, grape varieties and possible age. And then we smell it. And there's a lot to be inferred by the aroma of the wine, whether or not there is any evidence of oak on the wine, what kind of fruits we smell and what the condition of those fruits are. And that can tell us, you know, the non-fruit aromas can tell us about winemaking techniques. It's detective work. It's sleuthing. When we taste the wines on our palate, you know, we can analyze the structure. We can talk about if there is any perceptible sugar and the relative levels of acidity and tannin, alcohol. And that can tell us about the possible grapes and the possible provenance, the climate. And we do talk about any kind of earthy characteristics. But now, this year, it's really messed my mind up because so much of what we say about the earthy characteristics of wine, my reading is telling me that that's not necessarily true or possible. But I am not going to tell somebody else how to taste or what they're tasting is wrong. And so he details, you know, over a couple of pages, you know, all six wines, and he's quite accurate. He doesn't call the wine. He does call producer at one point, and of course he's correct. And so it's an interesting way of tasting because he details this throughout the book, that oftentimes when he's meeting with a producer and he's exploring this idea of micro terroir, like figuring out these different spots within a vineyard or something like that, that have variations in soil and soil depth and rock and infiltrates and things like that, that he will actually taste with the producer. He did this with Jean-Marc Rouleau and Meursault, and they tasted a bunch of different white Burgundy that this amazing producer in Meursault makes. And they did it blind alongside with a vineyard map that detailed the differences in the micro terroirs throughout the different vineyards. And they were kind of sussing out the differences in the wine. And I think that that makes so much sense, right? You isolate some variables, and he makes a great point that, you know, Jean-Marc Rouleau is like, he is a gifted winemaker. They are some of the best and most beautiful wines I've ever had the privilege to taste in my life. They are delicious and amazing. And he says, and this is a valid point, that what separates his wines from other people's wines? If it was just a winemaking technique that Jean-Marc Rouleau has, somebody else could copy it. So it has to not be something technical in winemaking. It must be something else. And I think that that's the tricky part with terroirs. We know it exists, but even Pedro Parra says he can't prove it. And so one of the things throughout the book as he's talking about his visits and his consultations in vineyards all over the world, from Chile to Tuscany to Oregon, is that he believes, you know, there is a correlation between the depth that the roots infiltrate throughout the soil composition, and the degree to which they can infiltrate fractures in rocks. And he believes that elaborates specific characters in the final wine. He just can't actually prove cause and effect. And so throughout the entire book, I kind of was looking for that. And it was a little hard for me because I believe him. I believe that he can taste wines and identify them by terroir. I identify wines blind in a different way, and we're both correct in our methodology. It works for both of us. But I kept looking for the like, but how, but why? So I feel like he would think I'm one of these like closed-minded people who like doesn't get his ish. But I was trying really hard to like figure that out. His techniques, it makes a lot of sense. I feel like there's our understanding of this cause and effect or this correlative effect, I feel like there's just gaps in our knowledge right now. And eventually they're going to be filled in. Because one of the things that was discussed that is not really discussed in this book, but was discussed in vineyard geology, is this idea of all of the other things that can create the flavors and the aromas in the finished wine. Because just the uptake of water and bioavailable nutrients by the roots into a vine that then will flower and fruit, and then we take the juice of that fruit and we ferment it, and then we're supposed to taste all that in the finished product. And I go back to that analogy that if we really wanted to taste the differences in terroir, we should taste carrots because they're root vegetables that are grown directly in the different soils. And I think that like a carrot terroir analysis would actually probably be fairly genius. I mean, obviously a blind carrot tasting is not nearly as delicious as a blind wine tasting, but it would be interesting to see if there were perceptible or measurable differences because you can eat the root, you can eat the carrot. And if you don't like carrot, like you can get a parsnip or a beet. Pedro Parra occasionally talks about the role of rootstocks because the simple fact of the matter is most of the world's wine producing areas were devastated by phylloxera, which is a root aphid native to the United States. There's no natural resistance from Vitis vinifera, European grapevines. The bug was transported to Europe. It basically spread nearly everywhere in the world. And the solution to the vine sickness and ultimate death was to graft these vines to native and resistant rootstock. And there's lots of different types of rootstock, and they have different dry drought tolerances and different soil preferences and moisture requirements. And so if you're planting a vineyard, in addition to whatever grape variety you're choosing, the scion, the top Lego that you're snapping onto the bottom Lego of the rootstock, there's a lot of choice. And so rootstocks aren't really discussed here, but I've got to think that that's probably a pretty important component in this big picture. And then also the microbiology, whether it's, you know, bacteria or the native yeast that exist either on the surface of the grapes or in the soil itself that somehow might create an aroma or flavor in the finished wine. Like, to me, there's just still lots of unanswered questions. And so this book was fascinating in terms of his study and pursuit of understanding the micro terroir. But one thing that is also pretty funny is while I didn't always get the answers I wanted, he didn't either. And he's very clear and very humble about kind of pointing out times when he was just wrong, where he would visit a winery and he would look at their soil pits and he would observe their soil pits and think that, you know, he's talking about a time in Tuscany he was doing this and the wines were great. It was a fantastic producer, but he looked at the soil and at first glance, he thought that the terroirs were terrible. And he was like, how do I tell the winemaker that these are really lousy terroirs? And then they tried the wines and he was like, huh, something's up here. Like, maybe what I thought isn't correct. And so he has a great passion for limestone. It is consistent throughout this entire book. He believes that limestone bedrock and limestone-derived soils are the key to the style of wine that he likes the most. And of course, our preferences for wine are entirely subjective. He has a little bit less affection for clay. He believes that elaborates a style of wine that is less to his liking. But he's also sometimes wrong. And there's different types of limestones and different types of clay. He spends a fair amount of time talking about granite. And as a Chilean, they don't have a lot of limestone in Chile. And so he's had to do a lot of study and kind of analysis with wines that are planted on granitic soils. It's very interesting, but it's a lot of the same. I found myself skipping around this book because in addition to the beautiful photography, and it's gorgeous. Like, a soil pit might not sound pretty, but it is pretty fascinating when you think about it. It's like a cutaway zone in a vineyard and you see all these roots coming out. And I imagine what it smells like, this damp, earthy smell and whatever, if that's geosmin or something like that, I don't care. Petrichor or something like that. I don't want to get into that, but you can just imagine what it kind of feels like to be kind of subterranean and taking a sneak peek at what happens below the surface. And it is pretty funny that he spends so much time in pits, I mean, thousands of vineyard pits all over the world, that one of his friends actually calls him Pit. That's his nickname, which I thought was pretty funny. In addition to all the beautiful photography and the illustrations of the jazz musicians, there's also a lot of like sketches and illustrations of soil profiles. And that's the part that, like, I mean, it's great. It's neat to like look at different vineyards, you know, that Jean-Marc Rouleau manages or owns in Merceau and see like the different micro terroir. But this book is so interesting, but it's also a little bit boring. Like, I don't know how to reconcile those two things together. It's a little bit of kind of both and a little bit of everything. One of the things I think was so cool about this book is as his kind of celebrity has been rising, He's incredibly humble and he is incredibly devoted to his family. He spends a significant portion of this book talking about his love for his wife and how she is so amazing, as well as his children. But he's become friends with some really interesting people. And so it was kind of fun to hop around the book and read more specifically about, you know, the time he spends and the friendship he's developed with Louis-Michel Ligier-Belair in Vaughan Romane, or Jean-Marc Rouleau, or Marcelo Retamel. So Marcelo Retamel is another Chilean winemaker, and he has long been the winemaker at a winery called Di Martino. I've only been to Chile once, and it was amazing, and it was like 10 years ago. And Chile is a really interesting country to visit, and understanding like a wine region's kind of place on the world market, it's never as simple as they haven't been growing grapes that long or something like that. But when you have like, I don't know, a murderous dictator like Augustine Pinochet, like the wines weren't exported to the world market. And so Chile is pretty interesting. It's a long, skinny country, and it's like an island on land. And I say that because it's on the west coast of South America, and it's very geographically isolated. In the north with the Atacama Desert, driest desert on the planet. To the east, it's the Andes, very tall mountain range. The west, it's the Pacific Ocean, and south, it's Antarctic Ocean. Because of that reason, Floxera, which I mentioned earlier, that grapevine loss, it's never made it to Chile. And so the grapevines in Chile are typically own rooted. They are, if they're still alive and they haven't been replanted, they are on the roots, you know, that were brought over from Europe. And so there's a lot of kind of fascinating old vine material to study. And a lot of what's been popular and a lot of what's been produced in Chile over the past couple decades has been relatively commercial, large winery kind of scale, a lot of inexpensive wines, but also some really, really special wines. And when I was in Chile, we kind of got the mix of everything from really large producers to some really small and boutique-y producers. And we got to meet all these cool winemakers. And I didn't know who Marcelo Retamel was when I got the opportunity to meet him, but had the opportunity to spend a meal and just talking and tasting his wines. And he was just this, you know, incredibly kind and quiet and brilliant winemaker. And it was really impactful for me. And so cool that as Chile's been undergoing a little bit of a renaissance, he is one of the people at the forefront of that. For a country that, you know, maybe is a little bit more known for a certain style of wine, there is a little bit of a new Chile that's happening. And Pedro Parra and Marcelo Retamel, they're definitely on the forefront of that. In particular, exploring old plantings of, you know, maybe less fashionable grapes that are planted in very far south Chile, in Biobío and Itata and Maeco, and things like País, which is like the Mission grape, or Sinsó. And so they're finding these really cool old plantings of wine and trying to essentially reintroduce them to consumers as a very terroir-focused project. And I got firsthand experience with this when, in a previous job, I was working for the Alinea Group, and I was working at one of the restaurants in that group called Next. And Next is a unique style of restaurant. It will completely change the theme of the menu and the decor and the wines to a different theme 4 different times a year. And when I was working over there, we were making a transition into a South American menu. So it was incorporating cuisine from all over South America. And I've been fortunate to travel to South America a couple of times. And so this was really fun for me. And putting together a wine pairing, which was super cool, to mix some of the more like established and mainstream styles, high quality producers, but more established and mainstream styles of wine, and mixing in some of these like new Chile style. And at the time, I wasn't able to get a hold of Pedro Parra's wines because simply availability and quantity that was needed to ensure consistent placement on a wine pairing. But we were able to utilize a wine made by a contemporary of his and someone who's mentioned in this book, a Frenchman who's gone to Chile. His name is Louis-Antoine Loit. And it was really fun to be able to have that conversation with guests in a restaurant about sort of what they knew and had expected, and then also this unexpected style of wine that's being produced. And that's something that Pedro Parra really champions. It was fun for me to like read this book and see these names of these people and get to know a little bit more about them and their perspective for making wine and things of that nature. So as I mentioned, this is a substantial book, and there's parts where, I don't know, it does get a little bit less gripping and less fascinating. I don't know how else to say it. As I mentioned, Pedro Parra loves limestone, and there are, I mean, pages and pages and pages exploring the different limestone terroirs throughout the world. It's fascinating to me because he talks about places that either I've been or that I want to go. And so it's a way to get more familiar with them. He even did some soil consulting. This is not about limestone, but in basically my old backyard. I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Charlottesville, Central Virginia, is prime wine producing territory in Virginia. It's not the easiest place to grow grapes and make wine. But he was called in to do some consulting for a project near Monticello, which is the home of Thomas Jefferson, the 4th president of the United States, and the founder of my university, UVA. And essentially, it's such a neat story. And I was so surprised to see Charlottesville mentioned, but it was so cool. So Pedro Parra's longtime kind of friend and mentor, Alberto Antonini, had a really long relationship with one of the greatest producers of Brunello di Montalcino, Gianfranco Soldera. They've been friends for decades. And one of Soldera's historic private clients is this man named Robert Hefner, who wanted some help putting together a vineyard project in Monticello in Central Virginia, right near Charlottesville. And what's cool is I think I'm aware of Virginia wines. I enjoy them. I like to drink them, and certainly you don't see a whole lot of them in Chicago. You definitely see a lot more of them around the Mid-Atlantic. But it was cool to learn about this new project, this new winery called, I think it's pronounced Ramisol, in Virginia, located very close to my hometown of Charlottesville, because Pedro Parra has done some consulting there. How cool is that? And it's so funny because he actually mentions a musician that I'm familiar with. Pedro Parra says he'd never been to Virginia before, and he only knew about its wine production because Dave Matthews, leader and singer of one of his favorite American rock groups, Dave Matthews Band, has a winery there, which is true. Love him or hate him, Dave Matthews got his start in Charlottesville, and no one who was born or raised in Central Virginia who's around the same age as me does not have some sort of like Dave Matthews story, for sure. But he does have a winery. It's called Blenheim, and they make some delicious wines. And I love that while I can't even come close to understanding most of the artists that Pedro Parra is down with, I love that one of his favorite musicians is Dave Matthews Band and what he knew of Charles' film. It's really cool. I mean, he talks about everything that I know about Central Virginia vineyards and how the climate is difficult because it's hot and it's humid and there's some very heavy red clay and it's not the kind of place that all grapes will certainly thrive. But it's amazing to me that this man who consults with some of the greatest producers on the face of the earth has also done some consulting in my home backyard. Now, for what it's worth, the soil type that he was talking about is gneiss, not N-I-C-E. It's a type of rock, G-N-E-I-S-S. It looks like gneiss, but we say it's gneiss. And that's the specific type of terroir that he was dealing with in Central Virginia. So every now and then when I would start to get like a little bit bored of these kind of explanations of all this different soil, then something will like draw me back in. And so there's a little bit of like give and go with this book. And I think it's helpful because this is definitely some, God, I'm going to make some more rock puns, but it's very dense material. And sometimes it takes a little bit of a, you know, an extra pass to get through some of this stuff. At the end of the book, which is always where so much of the juicy stuff happens, there is some kind of like summing everything up and bringing it together. Pedro Parra talks about Chile and its future and what the future from a wine producing standpoint is. The developing interest for artisanal wines, for old vine, own rooted wines, a growing interest in terroir, a growing interest in this idea of new Chile, sort of these producers who I was alluding to earlier who are kind of interested in discovering not the kind of wines that can be produced anywhere, but the kind of wines that can be only produced in a certain place, and this appreciation for a growing development of diversity. He brings things kind of full circle. And while most of the book details terroirs all over the world, the last few places he talks about with like stunning photos are all in Chile and talks about some really great producers and some really great wineries and winemakers that he's had the opportunity to work with. And then total full circle, one thing that was really fun to see at the very end, it's on the last page before the acknowledgments, he says that today is December 24th, 2019. This is like a journal. It's an autobiography of him writing. He says he just turned 52 weeks ago and he celebrated with his family and friends, enjoying a spectacular bottle of Soldera 2009 Brunello di Montalcino. And he's kind of having a little bit of a moment of reflection and talking about his ideas and dreams. But then one thing that's really cool is he talks about how he has, well, he's got an intern. He's got an apprentice, essentially. And he is a guy that he met, that Pedro Parra met when he was doing some work at a winery in Oregon called Rose and Arrow after finishing his studies. And this intern, this apprentice then traveled to work with Louis-Michel Ligier-Belair in Vaughan Romanée, and then finally came to Chile to work with Pedro Parra. He is a young, smiling 24-year-old Frenchman, and his name is Paul Krug. He is the eldest son of Olivier Krug, who is of the family of Krug Champagne, the sixth generation. Paul would certainly be the seventh. And it's so funny to me because I've met Olivier a few times, and parents are very proud of their children and like to talk about him. And he's mentioned before that, you know, his son works in wine, doesn't give too much away. But it's so cool to me that one of the people who's been taken under Pedro Parra's wing is someone from such a beloved and familiar champagne house. Who's to say if Paul Krug will ever make champagne, or maybe he'll just analyze champagne terroir. Like I said, there's a little bit of a back and forth, a give and go, and there's like these neat vignettes and stories, and then there is some very dry geology as well. It's a real mix. So what works in this book? Well, it's beautiful. He's got a very conversational style and he's a good storyteller and he's got great analogies that I think help explain tricky topics in a very clear way. The photos are gorgeous. Visually, it's an incredibly appealing book and he is doing something that is very cutting edge. I know he's not the only terroir consultant in the world, but he is a highly sought after one. He is a brilliant man. As for what doesn't work, I mean, me personally, it was just a little bit of a struggle for me to like take in all this information with all this other stuff that I've been learning and try to like not just always want to say, but how, but why, what is that? And I'm tempted, frankly, to try to replicate the kind of tastings that he's done. Now, I don't have the ability to like taste all of Jean-Marc Rouleau's Merceaux's, Somme TV, what do you think? And see if we can identify different terroirs. I don't think that I even have the skill or the ability to do that. It certainly gives me a lot to think about and also just makes me want to like learn even more about this subject and these gaps that we can't explain. And eventually, hopefully they will be explained. So I guess what I'm saying is there are parts of it, it's a little bit unsatisfying. I didn't get all the answers that I was hoping for, but I did learn so much more about certain individual producers and this very unique style of working, this terroir consulting, because it is pretty fascinating stuff. And for what it's worth, I mean, he's working with these great projects and the results are desirable. So he's doing something right. So for my rating, it's a tricky one. And especially because this is the last episode for this season. But I think I have to do another like split rating where it's either a buy or a borrow. And I say that because the content is really amazing and visually it's gorgeous. And this is very of the moment in the world of wine, but it's also very niche stuff. And for just like the casual consumer, this is, unless you just want a pretty, pretty picture book, this is probably not going to be all up your alley. But if you want to nerd hard and you like some of the technical books that I've been reviewing earlier this season, just add this one to the mix because it's going to be right there. And hopefully it will inspire in you, as it did in me, this like desire to understand and learn even more about this incredibly convoluted and mysterious subject. So there you go. It's a buy or a borrow depending on your own personal needs, but it's a great book. And I hope that one day I get to meet this guy because he just seems so cool and so amazing. So it's been another great run. We'll take a little break, but we'll be back for more later this year. And I hope you have enjoyed it. Don't forget to give us a listen, download. If you like what you hear, give us a like. See you soon. This episode was sponsored by Eldon Selections. Eldon Selections is an online Burgundy-only wine retailer, and they have a range of wines from everyday Bourgogne to some of the most prestigious Grand Cru vineyards in Burgundy. Go to burgundywine.com/somme to browse 5 different specially created cases exclusively for Somme TV. You can also use the promo code SOMM, S-O-M-M, and you can save 15% on your first purchase of $300 or more. Get some.